The Six Pillars of Freedom on Freedom 970 KUFO AM Portland.
Due to the Grand Floral Parade, Chuck, Carl, and Kevin have taken the weekend off. Please enjoy this best of edition of Investing Simplified and make sure to tune in next Saturday, June 21st, as special guest Rodney Wallace will join the program to talk finances.
Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Well, welcome to our live financial show here in Portland, Oregon. We got a nice day looking. looks like the clouds are going to get away, and we're going to have a nice day, I hope. And hopefully a nice Memorial Day weekend.
Looks and, like it to me.
Yep. And we do want to say right off the top here that Memorial Day is Monday. And it's a day when we honor all those that gave their life in the military and or had served in the military. And as a matter of fact, the holidays really kind of spread to honor anybody who's passed away. Originally, it was set up to honor those in the military. But it pretty much now honors about everybody who's passed away. But I do want to give special thanks to all those military families and people who have lost loved ones and who sacrificed their lives for our freedom. And I think it's a great thing that we at least honor them one day a year. That's for sure. Well, listen, with that, my name is Chuck Price. My voice just about went there, but I want to welcome Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm.
Good morning and happy Memorial Day weekend.
That's right. And Kevin Stege with the Baker Colson CPA firm.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Even though he's wearing his Oregon Duck shirt today.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. How did the Ducks look for football season?
Well, it should be an interesting year. Should be a good year.
Yeah. I think the Pac-12 is going to be really exciting this year. Yeah. I think it's going to be interesting to see how the Ducks do. This will be his second year, the coach.
I think so. Yep.
Yeah, second year. And I'll tell you, I've always liked to see the Ducks do well, but I have been rooting for Chip Kelly in the NFL because he's innovative and I like that.
He's pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, he absolutely is. Well, listen, guys, I know there's been a lot of things going on in the marketplace. I'm kind of happy about the fact that we have the watchdog on Wall Street right before us now instead of that hyperactive mortgage guy. And I've never been one to believe that you should use your home as an investment vehicle. I think it's one of the stupidest things in the world to do. And anybody who did it in 2003 to 2006 knows exactly what I'm talking about. If you're fortunate enough to still have your house, if you did that, it's not a good financial strategy. And this show, we want to talk about good, strong financial strategies, not ones that are not good. And with that in mind, last week we had a great week. Carl missed it. He was having a little relaxation, which is not all bad either. But we had Harry Dent on the show.
Sure did.
And Harry was very primed up.
Never short of opinions or perspective.
And I meant to send you a nice email I got from the people who are longtime listeners who listened to your answer and was very, very thankful for what you said about their situation.
Oh, that's right, regarding the
the property.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, the rental properties and then the development properties.
The sale, principal residence exclusion.
Yeah, and just for our listeners out there, if you do have a question or you do have a concern, and for whatever being is you don't have time to sit down with your CPA or your attorney or your financial guy, and you want to drop us drop me an email or drop Carl or Kevin, we'll be happy to answer it on the air for you. Of course, we won't say who you are or anything, but we'll answer your question if it comes in an email.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you can, by the way, you can email me at chuck@pfgwm.com. And if you have a question, don't hesitate to send it to us. Well, I'm going to give a quick stock report, and then because the market's been kind of coming up. And here's the thing is, for those of you that listen to Harry Dent and Rodney Johnson on our show, they have consistently been saying that when the markets hit the all-time highs, that's when you want to be aware. That's when they've said they've tried not to narrow down to a specific time or a prediction, because it's pretty hard to predict what's going to happen in the future and predict when things could come up that could change the economics. And in this case, we now are reaching all-time highs in both the Dow and the S&P. And I think we need to be very, very mindful of that if you're an investor, particularly if you're a long-term investor. I think you've got to be very, very cautious right now, and you've got to have a strategy. And if you don't have a strategy, I think you're going to get caught short. So I would highly recommend you have a strategy. The Dow Jones closed at 16,606.27, and it was up 63.19, up 38 basis points. But now, where's the Dow since 10,907 when the market corrected? It was sitting at 14,164.53. Since that market collapse recovery, we were up 17.24% in 6 years and 7 months. That's a 2.62% per year return. That's not exciting. The Dow Jones closed at on 12/31/99 at 11,497. So in 13 years and 5 months, we're up 44.44%. That's 3.42% for the Dow Jones that prior to 2000, prior to that, the previous 80 years, averaged almost 10%. That's just about 35% of what the long-term average was. The S&P isn't much better. The S&P closed at 1,953. It was up again this week. And it's been steadily up, and it will continue as long as the Feds keep printing money they don't have. So where do we stand versus 10907 at 1565.15? In 6 years and 7 months, we're up 21.43, or 3.26% per year. Now, if we go back to 12/31/99, the S&P closed at 1469.25, so we're up 29.35, or in 13 years and 5 months, we're up 2.26%. The S&P, the previous 80 years, was over 10% net return. So that is a big, big difference. Oil closed at 104.39, and gold closed at 1,293. And I'm just going to make a comment here about crude oil. It is absolutely insane to me that we live in a country that has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia, and we've got people stagnating our economy, stopping the production of oil. We haven't built a refinery in this country in 35 years. How dumb are we? How dumb are we to be dependent on other people when we could be totally independent of oil? And our oil prices, and I know everybody kind of laughed at this guy when he said it, when he was running for president, but the reality is if we had the federal government get the heck out of the way and we started printing, doing our own oil instead of printing money, if we started producing our own oil, we could have oil prices down in this country at probably about $2.50 a gallon. And do you think that would help the economy? Would that help people who don't have much money to get around to try to find a job? The thing we need in this country is we need jobs. When you're stopping 20 to 60,000 people from having a job in the oil industry, and then you cry and scream about, well, we need more money. Well, look, how about putting those people to work, having them pay taxes, and have them be productive in the country? That might not be too bad. And I understand all about, you know, all the environmentalists, and I'm just going to say this about the environmentalists. It's very interesting that after all the studies and all the crap we were told by the environmentalists that oil is bad, gasoline is bad, it's going to kill us, it's going to destroy the world, we need ethanol, we need to do ethanol. Ethanol's done two things, folks. Number one, it's three times more pollutant than gasoline. Now that the reports have come out, it's way more pollutant than gasoline. And it raises food prices. How smart are we as an economy? Listen, those idiots in Congress and the House and the president, all of them have been in office way too long. They have no idea what they're doing in the economy, and we need to get rid of all of them. And I mean, we do that at the voting poll. I'm not saying anything else. I'm saying do it at the voting poll. And, you know, when you get a chance to vote, vote and get rid of these people. Anybody who's been in office more than one term, I guarantee you they're not a regular person. They have no idea, and they probably are way wealthy than you will ever be. In fact, most politicians, I think Congress something has, the average guy has like $3.5 million in pension benefits. How many of you listeners out there have $3.5 million in pension benefits? How many of you out there have a $10 million estate? Not very many. I'm just telling you, that's what we've created. We've created royalty in these people, and we need to quit it. What we need to do is we need to ask you need to pick up the phone and call your senator and your congressman and say, hey, how about pledging your retirement and your salary to our Social Security benefits? Because I'm telling you what, there's a freight train coming, and most of the American citizens have no clue. But at some point, we have a way of passing the buck, and they call it kicking the can down the road. I'm telling you what, there's a day of reckoning coming, and it's coming soon, about 2017. There's not going to be enough money coming out of Social Security, into Social Security coming out, and they're not going to be able to print enough money to make those payments. So what are they going to do? We're going to reduce your Social Security check? No, I got a better idea. Why don't we just take all the assets that these guys have made in Congress and dump that into the pool and start paying some of that money back? And I always hear people say, well, there's not enough money. That's the problem, guys. There's not enough money. But let's make the people accountable for who did the wrong thing. You know, you always hear about throwing the baby out with the bathwater. This is crazy. We've got these people we keep sending back to Congress and the House, and they keep stealing your money. How smart are we? Not very when it comes to that. Well, I feel so much better now.
We feel better too, Chuck. You know, it's kind of have you seen the advertisement for Snickers where the guys, you know, the football player just goes crazy and they hand him a Snickers and all of a sudden he gets back and he's more down to earth. I think you needed that.
I like the one with Robin Williams when he becomes he's the coach.
Yes.
And he becomes the Russian guy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought that was the comrade. Yeah. I thought that was only Robin Williams could do that, but it was great. But I feel much better. Listen, if you got a question, you need to pick up the phone and give us a call. Hey, if you disagree with me, give me a call. I'd be more than happy to talk to you about it. Give me a call at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. And toll free, 800-990-0750. 800-990-0750. And by the way, if you want a copy of Harry Dent's new book, if you want to call in and you ask us a question today and you want a copy of the book, I will be happy to give you one if you want to come by my office and pick it up. Harry Dent is the co-author of a free newsletter, Survive and Prosper, and you can sign up for that at my website, or you can get it at Harry Dent's website at harrydent.com. I also have copies of the new book, The Demographic Cliff, How to Survive and Prosper in the Great Depression of 2014 and 2019. In case you don't know, we are in 2014. So I would highly recommend you read that book. The only thing I would say to you is, make sure you have a bottle of aspirin because it's pretty blunt. And Harry's pretty blunt when you talk to him, but his writing is pretty blunt as well. Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with Carl on the law and Carl's comments. So we'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
Due to the Grand Floral Parade, Chuck, Carl, and Kevin have taken the weekend off. Please enjoy this best-of edition of Investing Simplified and make sure to tune in next Saturday, June 21st, as special guest Rodney Wallace will join the program to talk finances.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepson, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Here's Carl Jepson.
All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepson, and this is the time for Carl's comments. And this time I thought we'd talk about a question that was given to us by a listener. And it says, Carl, we live in Oregon and have $2 million in property and investments in Oregon in a living trust, but have property in Washington that is also worth $2 million. Does the property in Washington affect Oregon estate taxes? And so before I give my answer, last week I kind of gave a general dodge around the question sort of answer. And I'm probably going to do a little bit of that today because it is much more complicated than you might expect. And fortunately, this week we have our tax expert in our field here. So he is going to, you know, hold the sword of truth and justice over my head as we discuss.
Is that like holding your feet to the fire?
Feet to the fire, yeah, however this all works. So basically, there are some complicated sorts of things that go into this, and the devil is in the definitions. And so I give you this as a disclaimer that this is just an estimate and a rough knowledge of how this might work. And Kevin is going to either laugh at me or not. But let me give you, first of all, the thought that I'm going to make some assumptions to make it easier, because in looking at both of the estate tax laws in Oregon and Washington, they are somewhat different, not only in terms of the exemption amounts, but in the way that they apply them. So I thought what we'd at least do is try to take a look at it from the standpoint of someone who lives in Oregon. That's the first assumption. And in this instance, I'm going to ascribe to these people a situation where, well, they do say that they have their investment properties are in a living trust. But I'm going to assume that that living trust was done a long, 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 long time ago and did not provide for any kind of tax planning, because then we're going to have all sorts of different numbers. But this is just as though the surviving or there's a spouse and the spouse has died and they now have this $4 million estate, $2 million in Washington in real property and $2 million here in Oregon. And so we're going to use that as kind of the base point, because otherwise things kind of lose any kind of accuracy very quickly. So first of all, we're going to look at, you know, and basically we're only going to look at the Oregon taxable estate, and which essentially the Oregon starts with pretty much what the federal government calls the gross estate. So we start with that, and then we apply. Oregon has a table of taxes and percentages that they apply to this. So you take the $4 million, it includes the property in Washington. So you take the $4 million estate and you apply the tax table and you come up with $257,500. Then you have to, as tax, then you have to add 11% of the
$500,000 over this particular table, and that ends up being 11% of $500,000. So you end up with a total tax amount that's calculated of $312,500. Now then, so you've included the property that is in Washington. So then you take a look at it, and you have to apply a formula, a ratio to this particular property to come up with the ultimate tax. And this is where it gets really, really interesting. So the numerator of that fraction is essentially it ends up being all of the property, including any intangible property. So your numerator, the top number, ends up being $4 million. And the bottom number is, guess what? The gross estate. So the denominator ends up being $4 million. So the ratio is 1. So you multiply 1 times the tax, and you end up with $312,500. So, yes, it does affect. Now then, it would be it might be different if you started with Washington. And there are many, many variables. So I'm not even going to try to go into all of that. But as a practical matter, they're going to try to get you wherever. Now, my view of it is that it probably wouldn't make a difference in Washington, because the property in Washington came in under, for non-residents, they only look at the taxable estate, tangible assets, personal property, and real estate in the state of Oregon or Washington. And so there you have the $2 million exemption. So you probably escape the tax there, because it comes under the exemption, so they never get to the formula part. So that's my thought on it. Anybody who's a wizard on both of those tax things that disagrees, I'd be glad to listen. But that's generally the idea I would have in mind. So bring down the sword of justice there, Mr. Tax Guy.
Nothing to swing here. So no, that was pretty good. And in general, you know, if you're an Oregon resident, your domicile is a huge thing. Where the person was living when they passed away, even when you have a trustee of a trust, say somebody passed in Oregon, but the trustee's in Washington. Well, intangible assets such as stocks and things like that, those things are taxed where the trustee is domiciled, not where the decedent died. Mm. So you really have to look at, know your jurisdictions, and like you were saying, I mean, basically Oregon is going to tax an Oregon resident on their worldwide, if you will, assets, and potentially give you a tax break if you pay tax on an asset that's in another state. And in this scenario, they didn't have to pay any tax to Washington, so for their $2 million that was in Washington. So Oregon.
So they didn't get a break in Oregon.
Isn't going to give you a break, yeah. And they're going to tax you on everything, on your Oregon property and your Washington property, because you were an Oregon resident when you died. Yeah. So that's then it's take the flip situation. Say they were a Washington resident. They had $2 million in Washington, $2 million in Oregon. How is Oregon going to tax that? You've got
same kind of a situation. They're going to look at the non-resident. The non-resident property for a resident, they start essentially with the gross estate as well. They start with Washington real property, Washington tangible personal property, and all intangible property, and they say that a resident's intangible property is anywhere.
Yep.
So they kind of start in the same place.
Exactly. Your Oregon return's basically gonna, if you're a non-resident of Oregon and you have some real estate and you have to file a return, you're gonna show $4 million on your Oregon return, but then you'd put a percentage of your Oregon property that's taxable as a percentage to the gross estate as a whole, and that's gonna prorate your tax.
Yeah, sort of.
Yeah, and even if it's under $1 million, say you have $3 million in Washington and $500,000 in Oregon. Oregon is going to tax that $500,000.
Yeah, but then they're going to be under the $1 million exemption, so they're probably going to be okay.
No, they will still tax it.
Oh, no, wait. If you're a resident,
No.
Yeah, if you're an Oregon resident, you mean?
No. If you're a Washington non-resident, you have $3 million, and you have $500,000 in Oregon. You have a taxable estate over $1 million. You have,
but you're a resident in Oregon, right?
No. Washington.
Oh, I think you said non-resident Washington.
No, a non-resident of Oregon.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And so if you have an asset in Oregon that's a taxable asset, even if it's under $1 million, if your gross estate is over $1 million, then you have...
And they have their... They're going to get
Oregon's going to get their pound of flesh.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
Depending on how much it is and what kind of property.
Exactly right. Yeah. Exactly. There's so many what ifs in this.
So, and I know that probably confuses just about everybody, including me. But I think really the only way that you can ever ultimately decide to, with any kind of degree of precision, is to be able to take a snapshot of what exists at the time of the death and then run it through the two 706 type forms, the estate tax forms in both states, and come up with answers. And hopefully, I think sometimes there have been some problems, and over the years there have been court cases that talk about the definitions of intangible property and the definition of a non-resident, and so it's taken some time, and hopefully the tax forms have kept up with the law, but they seem to have, but I don't know the answer to that entirely. But there are some calculations that get made, and I think suffice it to say that all of the states like to the extent that they can, they want to tax, you know, property that relates to their state.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and come back with the tax investigator.
And we will continue this conversation in a different manner.
Okay, we'll be right back.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over 3 decades, and its 9 attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com.
Due to the Grand Floral Parade, Chuck, Carl, and Kevin have taken the weekend off. Please enjoy this best-of edition of Investing Simplified and make sure to tune in next Saturday, June 21st, as special guest Rodney Wallace will join the program to talk finances.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
All right, welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we'll get continue that train of thought, and we'll just get right into it. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about community property and common law states. Community property states and common law states, and basically there's some real tax saving opportunities that you have to address. And this isn't just when somebody passes away. This is you need to address this as part of your estate plan. And in general, the benefit to, well, first off, there's 10 community property law states. Oregon is surrounded by them. Oregon, Idaho, Nevada, California, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and a couple others.
Washington.
Yeah, Washington.
Washington.
Yeah.
I forgot that
Oregon
one.
Oregon is the only one in the middle that isn't.
Yeah, Oregon's property. The common law state.
Exactly. And the benefit to community property is when the first spouse dies, everything's considered
each owns a half, essentially, an undivided half.
That's the legalese. That's right. Thank you very
undivided,
much.
Undivided, yes.
Thank you. And so when the first spouse dies, the other spouse actually gets a step up in basis on their half of the property also. And that's really the key tax planning opportunity here. And so, and we all know the step up in basis is a huge opportunity to get out of income tax. It really, this isn't an estate tax issue. This is an income tax issue with the beneficiaries. And so, when the first spouse dies, both the whole community of assets for this marital community gets a step up, which is huge.
Yes. Otherwise, the half that the
survivor
spouse had in the separate property stays at the same basis.
Exactly,
they get half the step up instead of the whole step up, basically.
Exactly, and so one of the planning opportunities here is what happens if you move from a community property state to a common law state. So, say you move from California to Oregon. That's a pretty common scenario and happens quite often. How is that property treated? Is it now Oregon property and you don't get the step up in basis, or is it community property? And there's been a lot of cases and a lot of law arguments over this. And fortunately, if you do things right and you plan it correctly, you can keep community property as community property. And we'll step away from that just for a second because we've got a caller.
Will, you got a question about a will? It's Rich. And you have a question about a will?
Yes. If a beneficiary is on public assistance and the owner of the plan anyway dies, is there any percentage or whatever that the state can come and claim part of that?
You mean if the person who dies was on public assistance? Is that what you mean?
The beneficiary.
Oh, the beneficiary, the person who gets the estate.
Yes.
And then the question is, but not the person who died. The person who died didn't owe any money or anything, and they weren't on public assistance, and they're giving an inheritance to the beneficiary.
Yes.
Who is on assistance?
The answer depends in part on what the public assistance is. There are some kinds of public assistance which are what they call needs-based, such things as SSI and such things as Medicaid. And those kinds of things are—and when they're needs-based— and they are those kinds of assets, then because you're supposed to, in order to qualify for those assets, you have to have, or qualify for those benefits, you have to generally have spent down your assets to no more than $2,000, at least here in Oregon. So that means if you get more than $2,000, you get disqualified for those benefits that are based on that. And that's why if you're going to give an inheritance to someone who has those kind of benefits, you can do what's called a supplemental needs trust. Sometimes they call it a special needs trust, which then acts as a supplement to the benefits that the person's getting. In other words, they can pay for things that are other than the things that are intended to be paid for by the benefit from the government. But they can't just take the money and do anything they want with it. It's held by a trustee, and they have to be very careful about how they administer that. So does that kind of answer your question?
Does this go into probate? That's when it happens.
A will would generally go into probate, and then it would and then the personal representative would transfer that. But if the person who's getting it, you know, that what should happen at that point, if it looks like by giving that inheritance to the person that's getting the benefits and they know that it's going to disqualify them,
then they can go through the personal representative, and the personal representative can establish a supplemental needs trust so that they can give it to them without disqualifying their benefits. But there, it's a fairly, you know, you have to go through some kind of complex stuff to do that.
But the state or whoever, they can't put a lien on the amount of money that they're getting.
No, they really don't. They don't. Now if they might be able to get, well, that depends on how it's, no, if it's from a third party, no, they won't. But
okay.
If it was, you know, so now, like in families, sometimes what happens, say, for example, husband and wife here in Oregon, if one spouse goes into, say, assisted care and they have to go on Medicaid so that they can pay for that care, they have to have facility care. And then if there's much left at the end of the day after the, say, for example, the spouse then later dies, the spouse in the institution dies. And then they don't usually do anything. But then if the spouse who remained in the family home later dies, then the state can come back to look at the assets of the surviving spouse who just died and can come after those assets to the extent that they provided benefits to the spouse. So and they do. There's a unit in Oregon called the Estate Recovery Unit who are quite diligent about trying to find, you know, people were a source of funds to reimburse them for money that they have paid out to folks. So, you know, it's hard to, there used to be a number of ways to sort of circumvent some of that. And there are still some techniques to do that, but they're not as attractive as they once were. And so a lot of people don't do it. There are a number of people who kind of specialize in those kinds of areas. They sometimes call it elder law, I guess you might say, but it's essentially Medicaid planning. But a lot of the tools of the Medicaid planner have been sort of erased over the years, and it's not nearly as easy to avoid the state coming back and getting their piece of the action.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for your program.
You bet. It's a
great
pleasure.
Program.
Thank you for calling.
Okay. Bye.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was a good call, Rich. We got a caller.
Bruce, are you there?
Okay. Bruce, are you there?
Yes, I am. I was wondering how much your estate can be worth before you start paying state and federal estate taxes.
What state are you in?
Oregon.
Oregon, okay. Oregon is a little bit stingy. They will let you have $1 million pass in your estate before it gets taxed. Anything over $1 million gets taxed.
At what rate?
Up to a maximum of around 16%. It starts out 10%. I was going to say 9, but 10, and then it works its way up to 16, depending on how much over a million it is. Now, the federal government allows you to transfer $5.25 million currently, and if you're a couple, that would, you know, be $10.5 million and $2 million under Oregon law. If you're fortunate enough to live in Washington, you have $2 million is the exemption amount. So that's the amount, and the tax is based on the value of the estate, date of death, as that exceeds the $5 million or the $2 million or the $1 million exemption amount.
You know, Bruce, that's one of the reasons why we talk about on the show about estate planning, because a lot of people, through the accumulation of their 401ks, through their investments, through their property, wake up one day and kind of, you know, add up all their assets, and wow, they're over $1 million.
Yes, that's why I was wondering if I should make my wife the full heir of my estate so that she would not be taxed, but she can have a life estate in real property.
Well, actually, that's kind of one of the types of techniques that we use. If a married couple has more tax planning tools available to them than a single person. And the most common one is to essentially do that, is to take the, because any transfer between husband and wife is tax free. But then they have the bigger estate. So
and,
when they die,
that becomes twice as big as my half and her half.
Right, exactly. So what we often do is put together a situation where at the death of the first spouse, you split up the assets of the two and put them into two separate trusts. And this, I'm simplifying this, but yes. And the ability to do that, then that what happens is that the first spouse to die gets to use their exemption when they die, and that part of it goes over into a trust that has some limitations, but essentially is available to the surviving spouse. And then the surviving spouse's side of it, you know, goes into another trust. And so when she dies or he dies, depending on whichever spouse is surviving, the survivor spouse's section gets taxed, and hopefully, you know, then that person gets to use their $1 million or $5 million exemption. So the practical effect is that under Oregon law, you can probably give, you know, if everything works right, you can pass $2 million tax-free under Oregon law. But you got to plan that before the first spouse dies. If you don't, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay. And could you also tell me what mileage is for business and medical this year?
Sure can. For business miles, it is 56.5 cents per mile. And medical mileage is somewhere here. It's 23 cents, I believe.
Okay.
Yep.
Not as important to go to the doctor as to go to work, huh?
So. yes, exactly. That's about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bruce, for your call.
Kevin, as you were saying.
Yeah, you know, with our, this is actually a topic I wanted to spend a little time on. So what I'm going to do is just briefly wrap it up, and I know we'll you've got a few items to share here before we get off the air. So
no, you go right ahead.
No. So, but you know, regarding the community property and separate property, a lot of tax planning opportunities, especially if you're moving into a state or moving out of a state of a different law that's in effect. And even some of the separate property states, there's a group of them that have agreed to a certain set of rules, and there's another group of them that have a different set of rules. In fact, very broad rules that say, some of them even say, well, you can elect your property to be treated as any other state's jurisdiction.
Yeah, actually, Oregon, there is a law here in Oregon called the Uniform Community Property Act, I believe, that close to that. And it basically does that. It allows a person who moves into the state who brings community property with them to allow them to preserve that as community property.
Mm-hmm. And that needs to be done. If there's a certain bookkeeping and accounting that you have to follow too with that, because you have to keep those assets separate to make sure that you show that, hey, this was the community property that was brought in. These are the earnings and the income that it's made over X number of years since I came in. Mm-hmm. And to be able to get the step up on that, it is huge for income tax purposes. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to find out, investigate here, if you move from Oregon to Washington, can you sign a CPA, not a certified public accountant, but a community property agreement, and convert your Oregon assets into community property?
Price Financial Group, wealth management.
Due to the Grand Floral Parade, Chuck, Carl, and Kevin have taken the weekend off. Please enjoy this best of edition of Investing Simplified, and make sure to tune in next Saturday, June 21st, as special guest Rodney Wallace will join the program to talk finances.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
If I had a $1 million.
Well, if you've got $1 million, you better pick up the phone and give us a call real quick and make some decisions on how you want to retain that $1 million in the future, and to make sure that you do it legally and under the tax laws and in a wise investment style. Wouldn't that kind of cover all three?
That's right. Avoid the gambling route with it.
Yeah. I definitely wouldn't follow the story we heard about the CPA in the previous segment. That was not good choices. Yeah. You know, Kevin, one of the things talking about the IRS that from time to time comes up, we get calls from people who get that letter from the IRS saying that you owe $30,000 in back taxes or you owe whatever. And that's a scary moment. So I just thought in asking you time, because we kind of ran out in your segment, I was going to ask you today, when somebody gets a letter like that, I mean, I always tell them, they call me, I don't know if Carl gets those calls, but I always tell them, listen, you need to talk to a CPA, because let's first of all find out what your situation is here, because otherwise we're just taking a wild guess. Hey, we got a quick question here. Sally's on the line. Sally, are you there?
Hi.
Hi, Sally. And you got a question about trusts?
Yes. When do you establish a trust for, when would you do that? And is there a specific circumstance, or is there a dollar amount that needs for the value of an estate? And then also, do deeds need to be changed as well as auto registrations? And how does that affect, for example, auto insurance? Would you need to list the trust as an additional insured?
Okay, that's a bunch of questions. Yes.
Sorry.
The answer to most of those were yes. Yeah. Basically, there's no specific time to establish a trust. It can be done any time as long as the trustor, the person who creates the trust, is competent. You know, if you wait until you're, you know, not, and then you can't. But then the way that the trust works is you transfer assets into the trust. If it's real property, you transfer it via deed. If it's bank accounts and things, you go to the bank and they have forms that you transfer it into the name of the trust. Let's see, what was the other answer that you want?
Autos.
Pardon me?
Your autos, that would be the same thing.
I usually don't transfer automobiles because people tend to change them, but you can, you can put them in the trust. You got to go down to the DMV and they charge, $100 to transfer the title to it. You can do that. And as far as insurance, it shouldn't make any difference to your insurance, because even though it's in the name of the trust, but I think what I would do is I would, if you do that, name them, you know, I always recommend to my folks that they contact their homeowner's insurance company if they transfer their asset into the trust, because, you know, even though it's a kind of a look-through type entity, it just makes sense that your insurance company would want to at least know. Contact the agent and find out if their company or your policy requires naming them as an additional insured. As a general rule, I don't think it is, but, you know, some insurance companies have different policies. So,
is there a dollar amount that, as far as establishing a trust in an estate?
No, not really.
Is worth $1 million or $2 million or?
No, the $1 million part of it has to do with Oregon's inheritance tax exemption amount. An individual can transfer up to $1 million tax-free, inheritance tax-free. Federal government allows you now 10.34 million dollars. So most people aren't there. But obviously, if you have a very, very small estate, you may want to. Well, it depends. Actually, it can be very economical when you think about it. The probate process can be substantially more expensive than most trusts, and so if you have a smaller estate, the cost to the estate is much greater if it's a smaller estate than it is if it's a large estate. But by the same token, that may mean that you want to keep more of your money in your pocket and subtract the cost of administration from your heirs. It's just kind of a personal preference, I think. Many of my clients feel that they want to create a trust because they really want to spare their heirs, usually their children, from the complexity and time and frustration, if you will, of going through a probate process, which takes some time. It's at least 6 months in general, and it involves some expense. There's a lot of paper trail that the lawyer has to put together to get it through there. And it does have some significant expense that goes with it. And the trust really shortens that up quite a bit and also minimizes it. There still may be some cost depending on the nature of the trust. But a lot of times people who are husband and wife, say, for example, and they own all of their property as husband and wife and as joint tenants with right of survivorship, they may not really need a trust except in the situation where they're going to be, killed at the same time. But if one of them dies, everything automatically goes to the surviving spouse. But there again, that depends on whether or not they have their assets separate or are they jointly held. So, there are various reasons why you might want to have a trust established. I think, any time that you have substantial assets, it might be useful to look at because it also provides some mechanism for managing those assets in the event that you become incapacitated. So it's an individual thing, but
Sally, I think what you're kind of maybe looking for is that one of the things that we recommend to our clients, if they have some assets, is one of the great things a trust does is afford you the privacy. It's not public information. If you go through probate, it is all public information. People can. There's a lot of bad people out there that look just to scam people when they inherit a lot of money or they have some assets. So to me, a living trust, from my point of view, not being an attorney, but from my point of view from planning and working with my clients, is I like them to have a trust because they got the privacy. Nobody knows their situation. And from a standpoint of settling the estate from an investment side, if the client has a trust, we can usually settle the estate in a couple of days. I mean, once we have the death certificate, we can pretty much do it because they don't have to go through that 90 days to 6 months probate stuff. And so from a planning standpoint, I look at it different than Carl's got to look at the legal side. I get to look at the fund side. And to me, the investment side of it is it's quick, it's easy, it goes directly to the heirs you want it to go to, and nobody knows about it.
Uh-huh.
And okay. One last thought here while we have about 2 minutes left is you did ask about the tax savings. If there is a husband and wife situation and you have assets over $1 million, probably closer to $1.5 million or $2 million, then the AB trust scenario or what's called the credit shelter trust, there could be a tax savings there with the Oregon estate tax if you want to use that. But there's other methods around that too. But that's a possibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's pretty much a common way of doing it, really, is to split the assets of the husband and wife at the death of the first spouse.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Sally. Good questions. Very good. Yeah, that's always a thing, Carl. People that we talk to all the time, they depending on the amount of assets they got, they wonder, should they do a trust? Should they do a will? But here's the biggest thing I'm going to say. Do something. Don't have your estate where you don't have a will, or don't have your estate where you don't have a trust, where you don't have some things laid out of how you want things to go. Because I guarantee you, if you don't, they won't. It's that simple.
Yeah, they'll go somehow, but it may not at all be what you want.
No, it'd be determined by some probate judge.
Yep, and it's the rules of intestate succession are not always exactly the same thing that you might want for yourself. So,
yeah, and the other reason I kind of mentioned it, Sally, and you kind of got into it a little bit, Carl, but one of the great things about setting a living trust is you don't always have to do things equally.
No.
You know, you can have people, you can instruct them to do things like their stretch IRA. You can do things like making sure that the kids don't have access to the money immediately if you want to. There's a lot of planning things you can do. But, gosh, if you're out there and you're listening to us and you don't have a will or you don't have a trust, there's no time like next week to pick up the phone and call your local attorney and get one. So you're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back. Well, we actually got a little bit of time here, but we're going to be on next Saturday. So hope you all have a great Memorial Day. And don't forget those loved ones that have passed away, particularly the ones in the military. That is a weekend that we get to honor them. So thank you all very much for listening, and we'll talk to you in a week. Thank you very much.
Price Financial Group, wealth.